from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. With the Microfinance USA conference convening in San Francisco this week, we focus our attention on the industry, which continues to receive high marks from many for helping those in need who are struggling to establish themselves with small businesses. But microfinancing has also recently come under fire for excessively high lender profit and interest rates. We'll hear from a panel, and we'll take your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome to another hour of the Forum program. What has now become a $60 billion asset industry, microfinancing began with the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh in the 1970s as a way to help poor people, mostly women, out of poverty via small loans that help them establish small business operations. In 2006, Grameen Bank founder and microloan pioneer Muhammad Yunus, who has been on Forum, received the Nobel Prize as microlending was heralded as a means of ameliorating poverty. Now, questions are abounding about what critics are characterizing as excessively high lender profits and interest rates under the brand name umbrella of microfinancing. With the Microfinance USA conference this week in San Francisco, we thought we would have another look at the industry in this forum hour. Let me tell you who is joining us. In studio, we want to welcome Eric Weaver, who is Chief Executive Officer and founder of Opportunity Fund, which offers microloans and other services to working families in the Bay Area. Opportunity Fund is one of the lead sponsors of the Microfinance USA conference in San Francisco this week. And welcome, Eric Weaver.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Sean Foote, who is technology venture capitalist. He teaches a course on microfinance at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and is a board member of the Silicon Valley Microfinance Network and a trustee of Freedom from Hunger, a Davis-based nonprofit providing self-help through microfinance. Welcome, Sean Foote.
Great to be here.
Good to have you. And also we want to welcome Neil McFarquhar, who is on phone with us from New York, United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He wrote an article that appeared April 14th issue of the New York Times, or edition, I should say, the New York Times on microfinance, titled Banks Making Big Profits from Tiny Loans. He's also the author of a book now available in paperback called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. And Neil McFarquhar, good to have you.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have all of you with us. I want to begin, if I may, Eric Weaver, with you. Maybe you can give us an idea of what the Opportunity Fund is and what you do.
Sure. Opportunity Fund is a nonprofit financial institution. We've been providing working families with financial education and products that they need to get ahead instead of just getting by. So what we do is we make microloans in the Bay Area with an average loan size of $7,000, an 8% interest rate, and one-on-one business coaching. We also provide match savings accounts and financial education to help people save money to acquire assets.
And the convention that's coming up, this is Microfinance USA. Why are you sponsoring? What's it all about?
Well, Microfinance USA, we actually did it last year as Microfinance California. And we had some funding from the Irvine Foundation to try to spread the message of what we were doing. I was a recipient of the Irvine Leadership Award a couple years back. And so we convened people from all over California to talk about the impact of small loans and other it's not just loans, it's savings plus credit on how that can help people improve their economic circumstances. It was basically a huge success. We had 500 people turn out at Stanford University. So we decided, along with Kiva, the U.S. Axion Network, and the Silicon Valley Microfinance Network, to put on a national event this year, which is happening Thursday and Friday at Yerba Buena and the Westin in San Francisco.
You mentioned Kiva, which you are partners with. Kiva, certainly, they've been on Forum as well and are quite reputable, but they've come under some fire recently as well because they're going to organizations and not to individuals, and a lot of their appeal has been that they would do microfinancing person to person or individual to individual. In fact, it makes people give more when they think there's that individual connection. Can I get you to comment on that?
Absolutely. You know, what Kiva is tapping into is the same kind of fundraising model that's been used for decades with, you know, sort of sponsor a child kind of, you know, here's the person that you're we're going to send you the name of this child, and this is who you're helping to feed. In fact, Kiva, the lender is very directly linked up with the individual borrower. It is not true, as some people might have thought, which if you think about it is kind of crazy, that Kiva, you know, was running around in the hills of Uzbekistan giving loans to goat herders and saying your loan is from Michael Krasny. What they are doing is working with reputable microfinance institutions that have a very strong track record. Kiva put us through a really exhaustive due diligence process before we started working with them. And then,
but it's the institution that makes and administers the loan.
We make and administer the loan, but we then put that person's story up on Kiva, and a group of people in the U.S. and around the world provide the funding for that loan and take on the lending risk, so that it effectively becomes, think of it like a mortgage broker or a bank that's making mortgage loans and then selling them to Fannie Mae. It's true that they're using their own capital initially to originate the loan, but all along they're planning for that loan to be held by a group of investors. So we're doing that for Kiva's lenders.
Talking to Eric Weaver, who is CEO of Opportunity Fund, and we want to bring William Ortiz into the discussion. He's founder of Gentle Parking, a San Francisco-based company which manages parking facilities. He used a $10,000 loan from Opportunity Fund to increase his workforce during the recession, and glad to have you here, William Ortiz.
Having me, Dr. Krasny.
Tell us about this process. Why did you go to Opportunity Fund, and has it made the world of difference in your business?
It's not only made a world of difference in my business, it's made a world of difference in my community. I, like other Americans across the nation, was deeply affected by the recession with the housing meltdown. I had a golden idea for a parking opportunity, and banks just were not even, they didn't even want to meet with me due to my credit base on my housing situation. I found Opportunity Fund, and they coached me and mentored me. They not only gave me a loan at the end of the process, but they enabled me to know what a performa is, what a P&L is, to make sure that I have a viable and solid business. I mean, before I actually got the money, I worked with them for almost a year until my business model was solid. And look at me now. I started with 6 employees, and now we're up to 25.
This is a success story. Obviously.
Yes. And not only for me, but for the people we employ. See, it might be an industry, banks might be making money, but in my neighborhood, we're a success story. We're feeding people.
What about the argument that America is such an abundant country, and the whole idea of microfinancing originally was to help the third world, that by helping you, it's great that you've been helped and everything, but this sort of operation and this kind of help should be extended more into the developing or third world?
Well, I just asked those people to come see where I was raised in the San Francisco Mission District during the 80s and the crack epidemic, and coming from immigrant parents from third world countries. People forget we have poverty in America. I mean, the only difference is America's beautiful, that anybody with determination and hard work can make anything happen.
Well, I want to congratulate you and thank you for joining us this morning, and wish you continued success.
Thank you, Dr. Krasny.
William Ortiz, who is founder of Gentle Parking, a San Francisco-based company which manages parking facilities. And again, he used a $10,000 loan from Opportunity Fund to increase his workforce during the recession. Neil McFarquhar is with us. He's United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and wrote this article that has caused a lot of concern, that appeared in the April 14th edition of the Times on microfinance, called Banks Making Big Profits from Tiny Loans. And essentially, a lot of the thrust of the article was that there are banks and financial institutions which are dominating, with interest rates really up and above of 100%. A lot of loan sharks have got in the microfinance business. I think that's the bottom line, isn't it, Neil?
I think there's a lot of soul searching going on in the whole microfinance industry, because it was started as sort of a feel good, do good sort of nonprofit venture, and it has become, as you said, a $60 billion industry. And with that, some large banks and financial institutions have discovered that there are big returns in lending to small borrowers, and so there's a discussion going on within the industry of how much is too much, what is a reasonable interest rate, and what is a reasonable profit rate, and when are you still in microfinance, and when do you move beyond that into loan sharking or at least unsavory lending practices.
Microfinance is a good brand name to kind of cover loan sharking, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's the problem, is that because it has such a good reputation, anybody lending money to, you know, any impoverished part of the population just immediately slaps that label on it, and it doesn't always fit.
And we've got hearings going on this on Capitol Hill?
There was some hearings earlier this year, just sort of raising this question about, you know, who is what organizations might be scamming the poor. But I think that the larger discussion is going on in microfinance itself, because I mean, you had Mr. Weaver on earlier talking about, you know, companies doing due diligence, but I found, you know, a lot of these websites like Kiva and like MicroPlace, which is run by eBay in your area, were advertising, you know, interest rates for Lapo, for example, a microfinance organization in Nigeria, that just were inaccurate, and they were much higher than what they were advertising on their websites.
What's the sense from your research about how much do-good is done well by microfinancing? In other words, the impact, some say it's small, it's not necessarily life-changing, it's certainly no panacea, but others say that it's really helped bring an extraordinary number of people out of poverty. Can we quantify that?
It's hard to quantify. I mean, you know, the conditions vary so much from country to country. I think the criticism is that it's oversold, because, you know, not everybody is a entrepreneur waiting to be discovered. But the support is that it does do good, because, you know, the lowest rung, the poorest of the poor, don't have access to credit, and often this is their only route to get it. And it may not lift them out of poverty, but it certainly sort of softens the blows that they face in their livelihoods on a day-to-day basis.
Well, a good deal of the research that you did, and I commend you for it, was about some of these loan sharks south of the border, Mexico, and a group called, microfinance group called Te Creemos. They're lending like over 100% in terms of interest rates.
Countries like Mexico and Nigeria are where these kind of high interest rates appear, because, you know, they're big, 100 million populations are higher in Mexico, and I think it's 150 million in Nigeria. So there's a big demand, and the bank that the large population of poor people that the banks don't necessarily serve. And Mexico is interesting.
I wonder if these are the same Nigerians who keep sending me emails.
They got a microloan to set that up.
I don't know. Are they asking for microloans? But anyway, the Mexico drew attention because there's a group called Comportamos down there that was a small sort of nonprofit and you know, doing good. And then they offered an IPO in 2007, if I'm not mistaken, and they raised $458 million, I believe. And so when, you know, the banking world saw that, you know, a lot of them thought, well, we should get into microfinance if you can raise that kind of money. And they have about 2.1 million customers, I think, in Mexico, and their average interest rate and fees is 82%. Now, the Mexican average is 70%. And so what the experts say and what the, you know, evaluating companies say is that if you have the largest players like that and they're not trying to force down interest rates, then all the little ones coming in are also going to charge high interest rates because they can get away with it.
Well, when I read your article, I was also struck by the fact that Muhammad Yunus said there ought to be interest rates between 10% and 15%. That's Muhammad Yunus of Grameen Bank. And that ought to be the ceiling. So he's defining that as anything above that being in a red zone. And from your research, we've got 75% of the institutions in the red zone.
Yeah, that's an ongoing debate, because they, you know, while people respect Mr. Yunus enormously for pioneering the field, they say that, you know, his experience in Bangladesh obviously colors the way he looks at the sector, and so, you know, the cost of servicing loans, and, you know, that's where the big cost comes in. Obviously, if you're giving $50 to 10 people, it's much more expensive than giving $1,000 to one. And he looks at it from Bangladesh point of view, where, you know, you don't have to pay loan officers very much, et cetera. So he can keep his costs down. Whereas in other countries, you know, in Mexico or Nigeria, the cost of living is slightly higher, so you have to pay your loan officers more. So you can't keep it as low. You know, that's the point, that it does vary from country to country. But there is a whole conversation going on among people who run, you know, some of these transparency websites and some of these organizations and banks, etc., whether you can come up with a standard and sort of a formula that fits around the world for what's fair.
Yeah, they're trying to even define what transparency is and what social investing is. It's sort of fascinating to go to those websites. Neil McFarquhar, again, with us from New York this morning, who is United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times and wrote the article in the New York Times, April 14th edition, Banks Making Big Profits from Tiny Loans. Well, Sean Foote's with us in studio. He's technology venture capitalist and teaches a course on microfinance at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and is a board member of the Silicon Valley Microfinance Network and a trustee of Freedom from Hunger, which is a Davis-based nonprofit providing self-help through microfinance. And from your perspective, Sean Foote, a lot of this is necessary.
Absolutely. And, you know, it starts with the fact that this is a huge problem that we're trying to go after. Depending on how you count, there's 1 billion to 2 billion people who are living in poverty around the world, which is, you know, 3 to 6 United States worth of people. And when you have a problem that big, you know, we need lots of tools in the toolkit in order to solve this problem. And microfinance is, you know, potentially one of them. And it's shown some, you know, really early good results. You know, because the problem is so big, the interesting challenge is whether a nonprofit approach can solve this entire problem. So in the United States, just as an example, the United States gross domestic product is $14 trillion, but the charity sector is $350 billion. Charity in the United States is only 3%. And it's hard to address a problem that addresses 2 billion people with just 3% of your resources. So the goal is to figure out how to get profit-minded people, and profit doesn't necessarily mean greedy. Profit means profit, to get profit-minded people to try to solve these problems.
But profit can mean greedy, and in these cases that we're talking about, unfortunately, it does. But you're saying to some extent these kind of institutions that have become a part of microfinancing are maybe a necessary not necessarily evil, but are necessary.
I'd say profits are necessary. You know, it's certainly an issue of context. So if we talked about Compartamos earlier, you know, Mexico is an interesting case because credit card rates for regular consumers in Mexico are between 50 and 70%. So to United States ears, thinking about microfinance interest rates of 80 to 90% sounds egregious, usury, but credit card rates are 50 to 70%. And given that the credit card companies don't have their collection agents show up at people's doorsteps to collect the money. You know, microfinance is an expensive proposition. There's no bank branches in these villages. You've got to drive somebody out there on a scooter or a bicycle in order to collect $2 a week.
I wonder if you're probably familiar with a political researcher named Matthew Rubin, who has essentially brought to public attention that the popularity of microfinance has perhaps been hurting to other ways of ameliorating poverty. In fact, anti-poverty measures have been diminished because of microfinance, is his thesis.
I think we need every tool in the toolkit. You know, our friend Jonathan Lewis has a great quote, which I'm going to steal here, which is, how many of us want to live in a town that has terrible roads, no schools, bad water, no health care, no hospitals, but a great bank? It's an unusual situation that we wouldn't want to live in. And you need all of those things in order to get people out of poverty. You know, and microfinance so far has been one of the really interesting tools because it is
lifting people out of poverty.
It is improving their lives. I think that the problem is focusing on this word alleviate or ameliorate poverty. You know, I think that's a level of hype that's going to be hard for any tool to stand up to, you know. And there's this hype curve. Anytime something new comes along, you know, I was an investor in the dot-com boom, and you know, the hype clearly exceeded reality. But now, 10 years later, the internet is a part of everybody's lives, and we've sort of gotten past it. Turns out, the internet is really good, despite the hype, despite the crash.
You weren't one of those pet food investors.
No, although I have good stories about that. We can tell another time.
Well, actually, microloans can some are say drive down the market power if there are too many borrowers making the same product. This is also of concern, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, again, with microfinance being only one tool, you have to put other things alongside microfinance. And organizations like Freedom from Hunger and Opportunity Fund are doing things like, in addition to microfinance, they package education with it, whether it's malaria education. So a lot of people don't know that malaria comes solely from mosquitoes, or
An entrepreneurial education, entrepreneurial, like you heard from Mr. Ortiz, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And
which means more success usually, in fact. I think that's been quantified.
It has been quantified by folks like Freedom from Hunger. I think to Neil's earlier point, it's really difficult to measure results of any sort of social improvement activity. So the results generally show progress. But it's hard to do things like find control groups and things like that in order to make the results.
Do you see any good best practices or any results, particularly on the international scale, that you would point to? Did the arrow go to a particular country, for example? Or
It is a big market, and so there are best practices in a bunch of different categories. So Freedom from Hunger is great for packaging additional services alongside microfinance. There's an organization in Bangladesh that I spent time with called ASHA, A-S-A, that is the low-cost provider. So talking about the interest rates being high because the cost to deliver are high, ASHA's entire mission is to become the Ford Motor Company of microfinance, to just repeat, 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 and drive the cost down as low as possible. And their costs are extraordinarily low to deliver services in Bangladesh.
Well, I was also reading, Neil McFarquhar, that the trend is for the average rates, interest rates, actually somewhat to be declining.
Yeah, the global trend has been
this is a global trend, down. Yeah.
And I think that there were countries in South America, for example, like Bolivia and Peru, that started with very high rates, similar to where you see Mexico is now. And as more organizations opened up, the profits drove it down. And there was a situation in Nicaragua where, when the Sandinistas came back to power, President Ortega was outraged that they were 35% the interest rates, which is kind of the world average. And a little bit below, actually. And, so he said he was going to get some Venezuelan money and offer loans at 8-10% and started, he didn't start it directly, but there was a sudden campaign, non pagamos, we're not paying, that sprang up in Nicaragua, and a couple branches were torched of microfinance. Yeah,
Daniel Ortega suddenly became
Robin Hood.
The would-be hero of the people once again, yeah.
Yeah. But then when the courts weighed in and the courts start saying, telling, when the banks went to courts to get their loans back and they didn't have to pay, well, that made large financial institutions nervous about lending any money to Nicaragua whatsoever. And so then that campaign suddenly dried up. But the point is that sort of the microfinance experts make is that competition is the best way to sort of leaven the market. And they sort of would encourage groups in the United States that are involved in countries like Mexico or Nigeria, where the rates are so high, to use their clout to try and bring those rates down.
I had alluded earlier to the fact that there was more success, apparently, when financial or entrepreneurial or business education was coupled with this, as we heard in the case of William Ortiz, who worked with the Opportunity Fund. And globally, especially in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, this is borne out by one of your colleagues, Neil McFarquhar, Kate Murphy, who wrote an article about financial literacy, particularly having a much more beneficial impact in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. We're coming up on a break, and I want to offer the phone lines to those of you listening. Some thoughts about microfinancing. That's obviously what we're focusing on. And you may want to weigh in here. Are you excited, positive, hopeful about all that can be done with improving lives? Or do you have some skepticism because of the fact that, as in most enterprises, it proved to be somewhat profitable, or largely profitable in this case, avarice can enter, and so can bad lending practices. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your calls. You can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a comment or question on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking this hour about microfinancing, the practice of providing small loans to the poor. It's been praised as an innovative way to alleviate global poverty. But the movement has been maturing, and some analysts are starting to raise questions about what they see as excessive high lender profits and interest rates. And with the Microfinance USA conference convening in San Francisco this week, we thought we'd examine not only the record of the industry, but hear from you, our listeners, about your thoughts about microfinancing. And so, once again, you maybe, in fact, have done some loaning through Kivo or another micro lender and want to share your experience or just have some reflections or questions. You can join us toll-free if you have questions or comments. It's 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. Or you can post a question or comment on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. With us for the hour is Neil McFarquhar, who is UN Bureau Chief of the New York Times. He's also the author of The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, which is now available in paperback. But he wrote the April 14th article on microfinance, banks making big profits from tiny loans. And Sean Foote, here in studio, is a technology venture capitalist who teaches a course on microfinance at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. And Eric Weaver is Chief Executive Officer and founder of Opportunity Fund. We also spoke with William Ortiz before, the founder of Gentle Parking, which was funded $10,000 during the recession by Opportunity Fund. Rachel, you're our first caller. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I'm a small businesswoman from San Francisco, and as I was getting my business started this year, I was researching types of loans, and one thing that was so surprising to me about microfinance was learning how much education is included in the loan. So my question was for the New York Times author, and I was wondering whether the rates he quoted in that article included all of the education and administration that the people taking the loans also benefit from, because it was kind of misleading to think that they were really just paying for the money that they were borrowing, as opposed to getting a full education, including getting the loan. Does that make sense?
No, McFarquhar?
Yeah, I understand the question. It's a huge industry, and it's all over the world. So the organizations that I was looking at did not necessarily include education packages in their loans. As a matter of fact, my colleague Elizabeth Malkin, who worked with me in Mexico on the article, she talked to a lot of women. They said, yes, we know that comportamos rates are high, and maybe we should shop around, but, I'm running a T-shirt factory, and I don't have time to go compare, and I don't have time to go to other organizations to read the literature. So not every microfinance organization, necessarily runs an education program alongside teaching people how to be better loan consumers.
Well, the reality is, in especially these impoverished countries, Sean Foote, you need an infrastructure, you need, basic institutions, you need water and so forth. I mean, we're talking about success with the possibility of microloans based to a great extent on what resources are there.
Yeah, and that entire ecosystem needs to be built out, not just for the clients, but also for microfinance institutions. So things like credit rating agencies for individuals, so that we can understand if they're becoming over-indebted. All of these organizations are needed. And the really interesting – the thing that is encouraging to me – so I simulcast my microfinance class to 50 business school campuses around the United States, and there's a huge demand for, or a huge interest in these types of solutions for filling out that ecosystem amongst this next generation of business leaders. And I'm encouraged incredibly, living in Silicon Valley where innovation is how we earn our living, that all of these business leaders are applying their intellect and their innovation to filling out this ecosystem and helping to improve the system and eventually improve the lives of a few billion people.
Eric Weaver, what has this relatively new U.S. industry of microfinancing learned from the international track record?
Well, I think the first thing learned is that people who might be seen by the conventional market as, poor credit risks, in fact, can be very good credit risks, and that there are market failures, that just because the banks hadn't been lending to people in the Mission like William or, what have you, that in fact you could make them loans, they would use them productively and pay them back. We've also been, there's a lot of technological innovation that's gone on internationally that we're trying to replicate. And I think we've also learned about including savings along with credit. I mean, I wanted to really put in a pitch for savings that – credit is...
You're doing a whole range of financial services, a lot of...
We are, yeah. Yes. Yes, we offer financial education, savings...
It's like a bank and a university all in one.
Yeah, well, you know, credit, as we've seen in this country with the recent, you know, mortgage industry, is really a double-edged sword. I mean, it can be a very positive thing for people. It can be a very negative thing for people. Whereas savings, in my opinion, is almost always a positive thing. And if you can, and it's amazing that even the very poor can and do save, especially if you give them the right supports and incentives.
Let me get another caller on. Virginia joins us from Santa Rosa. Good morning, Virginia.
Good morning. Thank you. I have been wondering for some time why credit unions are not included in the discussion on microfinancing. They certainly started because banks were not meeting the needs of poor people. And I remember some time ago their interest rates on a loan were 1% a month, which was 12% a year. And I know I have a friend who organized a credit union in Ecuador, and that was 30 or 40 years ago, and he went back, and it's made tremendous growth and done really well, and that's a credit union.
Go to your question here directly, Virginia, and thank you for that. Sean Foote, why aren't credit unions part of microfinance?
Credit unions in the United States start to look more and more like banks that just happen to be owned by their members. In a lot of these overseas situations, you know, credit union, you know, there's a whole set of financial services of which microfinance is a part, and they started with things like rotating savings and credit associations, which are like miniature credit unions. It's a group of people who get together and decide that they're going to start saving money together and lending that money out together, and you start with, you know, 20 or 30 people or 10 people, and that looks like a little microfinance lending group. But if that gets larger, then it's a credit union. And, you know, the development of credit unions in a lot of countries actually started as these small rotating and savings credit associations. So microfinance and credit unions actually have the same predecessors, the same parents.
Microcredit, in effect, is like a credit union loan. Plus, you've got all these financial services, including even insurance policies now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the reason why we don't say just microcredit anymore, we now say microfinance, is to try to incorporate this huge need. So there's savings, there's insurance products, and they all try to solve at least one – they all have at least one thing in common, which is they all smooth income and smooth demand. You know, a loan and savings look quite similar. A loan, you get the money up front and then you pay it off in small increments. Savings, essentially, you pay it off in small increments and at the end you have something the size of a loan.
So talking about size, Neil McFarquhar, is the problem here maybe in some instances too big to fail with microfinance institutions? Do they become – I'm being somewhat tongue-in-cheek here, but do they become like those financial institutions that are now causing so much concern to citizens?
I think that they're just, you know, because there is no standard, I mean, they're all over the map. You've been talking about savings a little bit, for example, and yes, it helps to teach people to save, but there's this program which is called forced savings in the business, and that's one of the things that I looked at is that, you know, the bank, the microfinance institution, takes a chunk of the money and puts it into a savings account, and the borrower has no choice, but they're paying you know, the interest on the full amount, but they're only getting a portion of the loan. So there was a woman named Anita Edward in Nigeria, and she borrowed like $666 to expand her hairdressing salon to buy more beads and et cetera. And but she they kept $100 of it. Now she was paying interest on the full $666, but she had, you know, $100 was kept by the institution. She said, you know, it's just not fair. I want the full money. I want to expand my business. So, again, it comes down to, you know, what are the best practices?
I'm going to look at some emails here. This is Chris who writes, has anyone worked to provide microfinancing on an even more micro level domestically? For instance, I paid off my neighbor's credit card, so now he pays me instead of Visa. And a group of us went together to help another friend get his teeth fixed who had no insurance. And he's paying us back regularly from his disability check. Has anyone provided a network for these kinds of micro loans, Eric Weaver?
Yeah, there are some new models that are doing that. there's an organization called Prosper.com. There's an organization called Lending Club, where you can go put up your very small credit need and strangers all over the country, all over the world can choose to lend you money. And, you know, though, whether that's, I mean, I'm always careful about the term micro. I'd like the term microfinance to have some standards attached to it. You know, and I think when people are borrowing money to pay off their credit cards because they had a wedding they couldn't afford or what have you, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not sure that's sort of economic development. But there are some, you know, definitely models on the internet now. Zopa is another one where people can lend to each other. And there's one that actually exists. Oh, Virgin Money, I think, exists to actually formalize loans between friends and family so that you can do just what he's talking about but have sort of a legal framework around it so that everybody knows what they're doing and it's all above board.
Yeah, and you don't have the internecine warfare that you often have when that is the case. And the loans don't get paid back within family. Families have been destroyed because of those kinds of things. Here's Benjamin in Healdsburg who writes, this morning I was reading an article in the current New Yorker, May 17th, entitled The Poverty Lab, about an economist from MIT named Esther Duflo. She studies the efficacy of various projects in second and third world economies. The gist of the article was that the microloan programs do have an effect, although they do not necessarily affect social changes such as increasing prosperity, greater independence, increased empowerment of women. She also studied whether the availability of free mosquito nets versus low-cost mosquito nets makes any difference in use-free as better. Ms. Duflo's experiments are intended to find out what works, what doesn't work, and how monies and efforts can best be utilized for the benefit of those most in need of help. Microlending may be helpful, but it may not be the best answer to the world's ills. And there we are again, Sean Foote, about, you know, just how efficacious is microfinance.
Yeah, it's talking about mosquito bed nets and the study of how these things work. These are such complex problems. You have examples of women who get microfinance loans. They work on their businesses. But because they're so busy working on their businesses, their children have to get pulled out of school to help manage the rest of the household. And so these substitution effects and things make it very hard to measure the results. I wanted to back up just for one second to something that Eric said. He was talking about, you know, there are market failures that these things need to fill in for. And it just occurred to me that, you know, venture capital, which is, I think, we've decided a huge success generally, despite the last couple of years, is based on a market failure. Banks weren't lending to small technology companies, and so venture capitalists came along. And so we have this situation now where the banking system is failing billions of people, and we're all trying to find the various methods and tools to help solve that problem.
Neil McFarquhar, let me get you to weigh in here on this whole sense again about the overall efficacy of microfinancing. I know we've been kind of dancing around it and talking about how difficult it is really to pin down conclusions, but what is your, if you'll forgive me for putting it this way, journalistic gut tell you?
I mean, I think it's kind of like the United Nations. It would be a bad thing if it didn't exist, but it's not always as effective or as idealistic as people would wish. And I think, you know, I mean, one of the concerns that sort of people within the microfinance orbit have is that if you try and make too much noise about interest rates, you're going to drive the organizations that serve the poorest out of the business. They're going to say, you know, we're getting bad press for helping the lowest people on the ladder, so, you know, we can get out of that because that's where the costs are highest. So I think what they're trying to figure out is a way to, you know, say what the best practices are and to keep it alive and without, you know, tarnishing it by turning it into the kind of money lending that it was created to fight.
And let me bring a caller in who's joining us from Sarasota, Florida. Elliot, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'd just like to offer a little story about an organization we started several years ago in the small town in Mexico where we lived many years, San Miguel Allende. And many years ago, I had met somebody who started Trickle Down, and it gave me the idea to try to help these young people. So first we gave them grants of about $200 to start businesses. Then we decided since we're going to be an entrepreneur organization, we gave them interest-free loans. And in the last few years, there have been 200 people that started businesses, and they're doing quite well. And we have an arrangement whereby we started a non-profit Mexican organization, which is all manned by local Mexicans. So they have the responsibility for doing all of the work. We just look in from the outside. And basically, we're funded by contributions from people in the area who care. We find this very successful.
Sounds like another winning story. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got the results to prove it, I assume.
Yes, we have the results, and the people are paying back their loans. We give them several months before they have to start paying back, and they pay back on the basis of what they can afford. And we told them there are two reasons why they should repay their loan. One is they establish credit line for themselves, and the second, which sort of astounded them, is that every time you repay your monthly loan, that money is used to help your friends, your neighbors, your relatives to start their own new businesses. So you become kind of entrepreneurs yourselves. And they kind of, their eyes opened wide. They didn't realize that these poor people were becoming philanthropists.
Elliot, thank you for that. Good to hear from you this morning and appreciate your calling. It also, as far as repaying, you know, Mr. Farquhar, one of the things we can quantify is women repay more than men, disproportionately, isn't it?
It's true, and a lot of loans have gone to women. It started as sort of collectives of women, and they had a sense of responsibility toward their businesses. And I think that that whole sort of repayment, et cetera, I think Sean brought up the point earlier, is that people aren't saying that, you know, these businesses or microfinance organizations shouldn't make a profit. They should make a profit so that they're sustainable. And the question is, you know, what is the bottom line to be sustainable? There's another organization that rates some of them called MicroRate, and it found a microfinance organization in Africa that was, charging 300% interest and wasn't making a profit just because they were, you know, their operating costs were so out of control. So that's part of the other aspect of this industry, is not just the clients, but the companies themselves, how they make sure that they can stay in business.
Aren't there usury laws, though? You start talking about 300%. I mean, it makes me blanch thinking about all those usury laws. Eric Weaver?
Well, you know, I think that the issue is not – I mean, I feel like on the one hand, an important point to make is I think there's more emotion about interest rates, about the cost of borrowing money than there are – you know, about the cost of other things. You know, people don't get so emotional if they hear that the markup on a television is 50%. But if, you know, the interest rate is something people somehow are extremely...
Because people think of their credit cards.
Well, they think of their credit cards. And I think they think of money as being something people desperately need, and they'll do irrational things to get it. But that said, I think, you know, at the end of the day... unless we want to, you know, a lot of the other countries don't have the kind of regulations we have here at home, and these things are going to happen. The question for us in microfinance, and I know at Opportunity Fund we really think about this a lot, is, you know, the issue is who should be able to call themselves a microfinance institution, and those of us in the industry should really be policing that. I mean, so if somebody's doing something that with making huge profits, you know, they're free to do that in that country. It's not illegal. But we should be the first ones to be, you know, to be saying you're exploiting people. You're not part of the microfinance movement. And I think people have been reluctant to sort of badmouth any other institutions because it's going to somehow reflect badly on the whole movement. And this really goes back to some of the organizations that are fundraising for microfinance. You know, they have promised too much. And they have been reluctant to sort of acknowledge where there are abuses. And I think that's what we all need to get beyond.
Do you want to add something here, Sean Foote?
Yeah. You know, microfinance is a big tent. And there's a debate within this big tent about things like how much profit is enough. And Neil brought up, you know, it'd be great if microfinance institutions were sustainable, which I think essentially means 0% profit, enough money that they can continue, but not enough that they can make a profit. There's room in the big tent for people who are giving grants, like our caller from Florida, or our zero interest loans. But this notion of sustainability, I find difficult to grasp, I guess, because when I looked before the economic meltdown in 2008, one of the things I looked at was just the average profit of the Fortune 500. The average profit of the Fortune 500 is 6%. And so it seems to me that we could gain a lot in any industry by having a profit motive when the only difference between sustainability, this 0% profit magic number. And being a Fortune 500 company is a 6% profit rate. So, you know, if every company that's targeting sustainability simply decided to target 6% more than sustainability, then we'd have a very profitable business, not egregiously profitable business, and we wouldn't really be having this debate about whether we should be sustainable or not.
Here's a listener named Sean who says, 15 years experience supporting microfinance on three continents, including founding one of the largest microfinance institutions in Bosnia, has led me to three conclusions in my current work with Reach Global. One, the very poor, like the rest of us, need a safe place to save first and foremost. Two, poverty is much, much more than money. And three, life skills education is part of that support that poor people need. Certainly all worthy observations from a great deal of experience. Can people still avail themselves of going to the conference, the Microfinance USA conference, Eric Weaver?
Absolutely. There is still room available. We've got registration is very strong, but you can go to the website microfinanceusa2010.org and you can register for the whole conference. You can also register just by session if you want to just attend part of it.
And once again, you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Eric Weaver, with Sean Foote, and with Nir McFarquhar. We spoke earlier with William Ortiz. And this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. We certainly would welcome your support. As you well know, what we do every day is dependent in many respects upon you. And so for more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to another caller, and that's Marta. Good morning, Marta.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say to Eric, to thank him, that, yes, I think that there have been many in the United States that have been micro loan, people who gave micro financing, who have been very successful, that they have had almost everybody repay. And I particularly am grateful for the Hebrew Free Loan Association of San Francisco. I think started in the 30s when Jewish people could not get loans from traditional WASP banks, and that they gave small loans backed up. I think every $500 had to be backed up by a cosigner of a person who also was an independent businessman. And that helped me buy my house when people like me who had a great college education but not much of a job or credit could not get a loan from a bank. So they paid for the down payment. House ran up from being worth $20,000 to $200,000, financed the kids' education, and a lot of other good things. So, yes, please, more. There are poor people in the United States, even educated poor people, and microfinance is surely a great solution for many of us.
Well, thank you, Marta. Good to hear from you. And here's another listener named Joanne who says, on the topic of domestic financial assistance, can Opportunity Fund be helpful for low-income or impoverished people who are hooked on constant quick cash borrowing but who are able to live independently with other sources of income, perhaps a one-time infusion of funds that don't revolve?
Well, that's exactly what – you know, in the U.S., we're really awash in credit. It's a very different environment than overseas, and where you have places where there's literally no other option except maybe a local money lender. Here, you know, we've got subprime credit cards, we've got payday loans, we've got you name it. And so what we're about at Opportunity Fund and a lot of our partner organizations is providing appropriate credit, and that means, you know, a term loan instead of a short-term credit card with a tiny minimum payment that you're never going to get out from under, combined with some advice on how to use the money and how to structure, you know, your finances of your business. So I think that's a really good point. A lot of people in this country do finance businesses on credit cards, and it's a very, very inappropriate way to finance long-term capital needs.
I've got a listener named Peter who writes, while a sophomore at Yale in 2001, my San Francisco-born and bred son and three of his friends wrote a business plan for, raised venture capital, and successfully organized the first microlender in the state of Connecticut, the Elmseed Enterprise Fund, of which he was the founding CEO for 2 years before he graduated. The fund continues to thrive and remains self-sustaining and serves as the model for other student-run microlenders run by students at Harvard and Georgetown. Part of Elmseed's formula for success in offering low-cost loans and minimizing minimizing overhead is that it has a not-for-profit business model. It's a 501c3, and is staffed exclusively by student volunteers. Competition for the student staff positions is even more selective than the process for getting a loan, sort of like our intern system, right, Dan? and thus also provides a great hands-on experience for the students. So you're hearing a lot of stories here that sounds like maybe good grist for your mill, Neil from Farquhar.
I mean, I think that's the point, is that the people are trying to find a formula to separate the good from the bad, because there is a lot, of good that goes out there. And, you know, I was sort of, when I was casting around for this stuff, I think it was Eric that just mentioned, paycheck loans in the States. That's something that's not regulated, and the interest rates for those in your little sort of corner place that go cash your check can be 300%, 500%. So there are outrageous interest rates in the U.S. too on some of these kind of services. So no one is saying that, you know, that it's not a great idea. It's just that there needs to be some standards.
When are we going to have standards, or do you see movement toward this?
Yeah, there's a group that's getting together this summer that sort of, Microfinance Transparency is a website and an organization that's sort of pushing some of this argument, and they're getting together a small group this summer in Copenhagen, and they're sort of going to try and hammer out.
Getting standards in Copenhagen may not be necessarily the best thing to do.
Unfortunate choice of venue, perhaps, but anyway, there they are.
Well, good luck to them, and let me extend thanks to all of you who joined us this morning for this hour about microfinance. Again, Eric Weaver, you might want to give the website for those who want to attend the conference.
Yes, the website is microfinanceusa2010.org.
Thanks again to Eric Weaver, Chief Executive Officer and Founder of Opportunity Fund, and thanks to Sean Foote here in studio, technology venture capitalist, and teaches the course on Microsoft at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and is a board member of the Silicon Valley Microfinance Network and trustee of Freedom from Hunger. Also, our thanks to Mill McFarquhar, United Nations Bureau Chief with the New York Times, who wrote the April 14th article on microfinance banks making big profits from tiny loans. He's also the author of a book called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. And we also thank William Ortiz, who joined us earlier, founder of Gentle Parking, a San Francisco-based company which manages parking facilities. He used a $10,000 loan from Opportunity Fund to increase his workforce during the recession. And thanks to you, our listeners, we wouldn't be here without you. We are appreciative of your being with us here every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour of forum is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.